James Rebanks is a farmer in England's Lake District in Matterdale. He has become Britain's most famous shepherd thanks to his social media presence and a best-selling book called A Shepherd's Life. And now comes another book, English Pastoral, An Inheritance. Rebanks learned to love farming the old way alongside his grandfather 40 years ago. But the industrial agricultural revolution changed everything. Now he wants a counter-revolution, saying we have become slaves to consumerism and strangers to the fields that feed us. Rebanks has run the family farm for nearly 20 years, and his family goes back 600 years in the area, and he's with me now from that very farm. Hello, James.
Hello, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Listen, this is quite a different book, English Pastoral, from A Shepherd's Life. More political. What politicised you?
I think really growing up is the issue. So the first book it was about growing up. The first book that I wrote, The Shepherd's Life, was very much about growing up in a traditional farming family, very old-fashioned farming family, and loving that and sort of realizing that that was perhaps a little bit doomed because the world was changing around us, but still loving it anyway. And this book is, to answer your question, this book's about the last sort of 20 years when I've realized that almost everything that an economist would have told me to do on my land would make it worse for nature, would make the soil worse, would mean that there was less biodiversity, less birds, less insects. And actually, copying that sort of American post-war model of agriculture is actually destroying my community, and it's not destroying the land and ruining rivers and other things. So I think it's, if I'm really honest and really blunt, I think it's time for lots of those farmers to be quite grown up about this, to listen, not be too defensive, listen carefully to what's being said about what we've done and what we're part of, and start to be part of the solution. And I think we can do it.
Let's look at the farm you're on right now. What was it like when you took it over?
So I thought it was perfect because I'm one of those people that loves wherever he's at. So it's a hill farm. We have 185 acres of hilly land in the Lake District. Anyone that's ever been to the Lake District will know it's these sort of little tight, steep-sided valleys, not much flat land. It's pretty much for pastoral farming, for sheep and cattle. And very traditional and small, crooked fields. And I was very proud of my family having looked after that land for a long time. But something else was happening at that time in my life, which is I was starting to listen to a lot of the criticisms from ecologists and others. And rather than row with them online, which is quite tempting sometimes, I started inviting them onto my farm to have a cup of tea and a walk around. And what I really discovered was that it wasn't even as good for nature as it had been 20 or 30 years earlier. So the hedgerows were getting old and disappearing. There was a lot less trees. The trees we had were quite old. And there was a whole accumulation of things we'd done over a very long period of time, which meant it was barer than it should have been and nowhere near as good for nature as it could be. So I found that an interesting challenge because I'm very proud to be a farmer. I'm proud of the things that we do. But I think there's a new challenge now, isn't there? We've got to feed a lot of people, but we've got to be cognizant of the fact that there's climate change happening and that there's huge loss of biodiversity around the world. And that makes for a really, really difficult challenge for farmers. But the more I'm learning, the more excited I am by that, because I think there's amazing things we can do on my farm and many others to make things better.
Interestingly, a recent survey indicated that the way people farm, intensification of agriculture, is a big driver of biodiversity loss, much bigger than climate change or anything else that people usually reach for to explain that.
And I think there's two ways of dealing with that. Some people do. You can get really, really grumpy at farmers and blame them and act as if they're sort of lunatics. Or more sensibly, you can look at what's actually happening there. And what is happening there is that there's huge downward pressure on prices. We've handed all of our consumer sort of purchasing power to a handful of corporations, largely supermarkets or wholesalers. And when you actually go to farms and you talk to farmers, you realize that quite often they don't like the things they're having to do to make their land or landscapes worse, but they're under enormous financial pressure. And that comes back to the rest of us. That isn't just something you can pin on the small number of people at farmers. That's something that needs to be thought through properly by societies. Well, I think we need to ask ourselves, what sort of farming do we want? Are we asking farmers just to be business people, sort of industrialists, to produce things as cheap as possible? Or do we actually want something more complex from them? Do we want them to be good stewards of the land, to look after their land in ways that would result in healthy rivers, to make sure there's plenty of native habitats, whatever those might be? Because if we want those things as well, and I think we should, then that's a much more complicated thing we're asking of farmers, and it requires farmers to be supported in one way or another to do them, really.
I mean, certainly here in New Zealand, there has become a kind of them and us mentality, farming versus what one could loosely describe as the urban liberal. Trying to break that down, right?
Yeah, so that's disaster, pretty disastrous, I would argue, for everybody. So I know why it happens. If you're not a farmer, all you're hearing is bad news, bad news, bad news. Birds are disappearing, insects are disappearing, soil's ruined. This bad news piles up, and you think, what are these people on the land doing? They're lunatics. And if you're a farmer, you're equally angry because you think, hang on a minute, you screwed me down on the price. You don't give a damn about me. You go into the supermarket and you pick the cheapest stuff up, and then you want me to be some sort of enlightened land steward. So there's loads of room there for people to have a sort of culture war and to attack each other on social media. But that isn't actually going to do anybody any good. What we really need to do is to work together. Basically, people in the sort of environmental green world and people in the farming world need to work together and need to find ways to think really carefully about how we look after landscapes, how we produce the food in them that we absolutely all need, but also produce the natural outcomes, the public benefit outcomes that we need. And the culture war stuff is a complete distraction. I'm not telling anyone they shouldn't be mad that terrible things are happening to the world, but we've got to find sensible grown-up ways to get out of this. And I think a lot of it's dialogue, and a lot of it is thinking about things like the price of food and how we shop. In the introduction, you mentioned Michael Pollan. I think many of us, when we shop, when we cook, when we eat, and when we vote, are going to have to start thinking about farming and good land management much more than we have done for the last 50 years.
All right. Well, we'll talk about how solvency and sustainability may or may not go hand in hand in a moment. But I want to concentrate on a couple of things. You mentioned hedgerows. Yeah. And in New Zealand, we're not quite so familiar with the concept of hedgerows. I want you to explain to me what they are, how they were made, and what happened to them.
Okay, so, I'm not an expert on the sort of ecological history of New Zealand, but certainly in the UK, what the UK was a sort of savanna-type landscape. It was sort of patchy woodland everywhere, lots of thorny scrub, lots of willowy scrub, lots of wetlands, lots of woodland clearings. Basically, all the flora and fauna that should be in Britain lived in that patchwork. And if we want a farmed landscape that has enough space for all of those things to survive alongside us, we've got to produce the bits that they need. Now, one of the fortuitous things that happened in the sort of settlement of England was that as early farmers, and then all the farmers after that, expanded those woodland clearings to become fields. What they did was they used the wild wood. They created hedgerows, which is basically taking thorns and other woodland plants and turning them into the field boundaries. So if you sort of mentally picture rural England, how it used to be at least, it's a patchwork covered in these sort of ribbons of green bushy hedgerows. And that's basically what they are. So they were functional field boundaries to farmers, and farmers like my dad, my granddad and others, that's how they divided their fields up, and it required a sort of 20-year rolling cycle of maintaining them, which is basically chopping them down diagonally and letting them grow again. But what was good about that, when you look back at that history, is that a lot of the biodiversity in the British countryside likes woodland edge. Now, that's a big subject, but basically they like the edge of woodland. And it turns out that a hedgerow is woodland edge. And therefore, when you shift away from that old-fashioned patchwork landscape with the small crooked fields surrounded by hedgerows, you might think you're making the landscape more efficient for industrial agriculture, but actually you're getting rid of the last vestiges of that wilder woodland savanna-type landscape. And ecologically, that's disastrous. So you can imagine there that gets really complicated economically, because then you're into a situation where it might not be a good idea ecologically to improve your agriculture in the way that an economist might tell you to. So that's where we're at as farmers in the UK at the moment.
And if you brought hedgerows back, what would that dictate in terms of what you farmed, generally speaking?
Okay, so the reason they had those hedgerows, the reason they made them, the reason they managed them was that they were brilliant livestock barriers. So the minute you specialise in agriculture and you have livestock in one part of a country and arable plant growing in another, crop growing in another part, in the crop growing part, you don't need hedgerows anymore. So the whole of southern England has seen hedgerows become redundant in the last 50 years, not maintained and not looked after. In the part of England that I'm from, which is the livestock part, specialised in livestock in the north and in the rockier bits where you can't do anything else, we still have a lot of the vestiges of those whole old hedgerows. And it gets really interesting because when you look at the latest science about how to manage grass most effectively and grazing most efficiently, lots of small fields is not a bad thing. A lot of the best thinking now about rotational grazing and mob grazing says that small fields are a pretty good idea anyway. So on our farm, it's a no-brainer that we should put those hedgerows back in. And I can do quite good farming in an 18th century landscape, basically, just with longer breaks in the rotational grazing. Sorry, I'm probably nerding out now, but I'm sure some of your farmer listeners will know what I'm talking about.
No, I mean, it's very interesting because hedgerows, and the other thing I wanted to talk about is your effort to rebed the streams. It's so inefficient, James, on the face of it.
It is. And if you like efficiency, I would urge you to go to the American Midwest and delight in the wonder that is the highly most efficient farming in the world. I know there's some bits of Australia like that, to be fair. If you can't see any problems with how that's worked out in the American Midwest, then you've stumbled upon a wonderful solution. Just keep talking about efficiency. But you know, I think, despite your devil's advocate statement, I think you know, like I do, that that's actually a disaster, that some of the least sustainable farming on Earth. They're losing soil. That's why the Mississippi runs brown. It's the soil of the Midwest running away. In some places, they've lost several feet of topsoil. There's been huge biodiversity loss. They've poisoned all of their water tables and have to spend vast amounts of money to even have drinking water in their towns. I could go on and on and on with reasons why that's not a good or sound farming system. So I think we need to talk a little bit less about efficiency and a little bit more about sustainability and biodiversity and resilience and robustness. Because the other thing that's really sad about that system is it doesn't need many farmers. What's happened in the American Midwest has been a disaster for farming communities and for farmers themselves. That's a system that plays right into the hands of big business and corporations and machine manufacturers and the people that sell all their stuff that drives that system, synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. So if I'm sounding a little bit like a like a farmer who's turned into an environmentalist, that's because I sort of have. The truth is the environmentalists are right about quite a lot of this stuff, and we better get our heads around it.
What you've described as the toxic horror of American farming, you're also pretty concerned about the potential US-UK trade deal. What do you think that's going to mean?
So basically, Britain has three choices at the moment. We can stay part of the common agricultural policy or very closely aligned to it. It's not clear what's going to happen in the next few days. The common agricultural policy has been fairly disastrous as a tool for managing landscapes sustainably and sensibly. It has not been a good thing for the ecology of the UK or for Europe. Most people would agree on that. If we step out of that, what are we stepping out into? Well, potentially, there's a second option, which is you have a sort of UK national policy that at the very least is compliant and at the same level as the European system, but could actually be better. I mean, in a dream scenario, you could actually have a better policy that was better than Europe's. And I wouldn't be against that. But it looks like we're going to take another option, which is actually worse than the common agricultural policy and being part of the EU, which is to join a sort of race to the bottom by doing a free trade deal with America, in which they will use all of their negotiating and commercial power to encourage us to drop our standards, reduce our regulation, hide things like place of origin labeling, and basically join them in a race to the bottom. And I feel very, very strongly that that's a mistake for my country and my landscape and my farm.
What is great about your book is the blend of pastoral and polemical. I mean, it's very beautiful, and it evidences your love of the land, which is why I want to get back to the rebedding of the streams, because because, you know, it sounds like you make water run the way it works best for what you want to grow on your farm. No, you say. So what have you done?
So everybody in my family for many, many centuries has believed that the best thing you could do with water was to get it off our land as quickly as possible. And bear in mind, we're not in a place that droughts very often. So I'm in a place that rains a lot. So people love draining land, improving land would be what they would have called it. And nobody knew why that might be a bad thing. That was just considered good farming, sensible sort of husbandry, drain the land, get the water off. But we, again, when you listen to what the ecologists are telling you, when you invite them onto your land and ask them, what have I done? What have we done? They're actually telling us that we wrecked the rivers, that rivers shouldn't be straight like drainage channels. Rivers should wiggle. Rivers should have gravelly beds. They should have slow bits, fast bits. So what we've been doing on our farm, with the huge help from other environmental charities and other people that care about this, is trying to rebuild that and then trying to restructure the farm around it. So we're changing the shape of fields in some cases, putting the rivers back to a longer, more wiggly course that goes through bits of the farm that my ancestors drained it out of in the past. What I hope comes across in the book is that this isn't me preaching at anybody or being sort of holier than thou. My family are very ordinary farming family that have done the things that every farming family have done. And I think there's a great deal of joy and beauty in doing these things. And if the rest of society is willing to back us to do those things as farmers, then I think we can be much more enlightened land stewards. And I think it makes life better. So the barn owls have come back to our farm. There's way more insects, birds, etc., than there used to be. And my farm's by the year getting healthier and healthier. The soil's getting better now. I've got amazing stats on the organic matter that we're managing to put into the soil. There's way more worms in it. It grows grass better. I think this is about a rethinking of what it means to be a good farmer, to include that ecological stuff. It doesn't mean I don't want to make a living from selling sheep and cattle anymore. I do. But I think we have to internalize this stuff and we have to work out how to bring it together. And I think if we don't, society will fall out of love with us as farmers. But if we do it really, really well, we can earn that trust back. And I think we have to.
Just make the link for me. Why have the barn owls come back?
Okay, so our farm was a series of very large fields that were set stocked, which basically means leaving sheep in most of the year in the same place. Turns out that's a dreadful way to manage grassland, a dreadful way to manage plants. So by creating all of those old fields with all of those hedgerows again, and creating wildlife areas and riparian strips, we've basically created the habitats, which led to an explosion of voles and mice. And within 6 months of putting the fences up to change the farm around in that way, the barn owls came back because there was food for them. It turns out that farmland produces the food for vast numbers of insects, birds, and other animals. And if we change land in the pursuit of efficiency to get rid of too much of that, those things disappear. And that's what's been happening for 30 or 40 years. And yes, we've produced a lot of food very cheap, and we can have a pat on the back for that where we're in the pub with each other. But it isn't the only thing we've got to do. It just isn't anymore. We've got to be big enough to accept that and try and find a way through it.
I want food I can afford, James. Why do I care about barn owls?
Well, if you don't, you're a dingbat, because we need the biodiversity around us. We know that if we're going to live in resilient ecosystems that will survive into the future, then we need things like healthy soil. We need things like healthy rivers. We can't act like it's the 1980s forever. It just doesn't work. So if you want to have a landscape in New Zealand and I want to have a landscape in Britain that is beautiful, that's full of wild things and produces lots of food because we're looking after it properly, then this is how we've got to think. There's no real way around it. It comes back to that Midwest thing that you said earlier. If you just care about cheap food and that's what you want me and every other farmer to do, go and have a look what that results in. It's ugly, really destructive, and it doesn't last for very long. That's why the UN's talking about as having something like only 60 harvests left in some of our most productive places on Earth. So why you should care is because in 60 years' time, your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren may start running out of food if we don't learn to farm properly and sustainably.
Let us talk about subsidies. Decades of subsidies in the UK, thanks to the EU's Common Agricultural Policy, have led to a huge increase in food production, as well as a huge increase in fertilisers and pesticides. And grants were given to demolish hedgerows. All of this is something that you would call a disaster. But what's going to happen to the subsidies?
So that's a good question, because large tracts of the world's farmland is subsidised in one way or another. So North America, which many of us think of as a free market economy, actually has heavily subsidised agriculture that's also destructive. So it might, in an ideal world, there might be no subsidies for agriculture, and food might be priced at a level that could sustain good, sustainable farming. In much of the world at the moment, it doesn't look like that's possible. So in Britain, there's talk about changing the subsidy system so that it's paying purely for things of public benefit, wildlife, flood alleviation, hedgerows, woodland, whatever it might be. But there's potentially a problem there, isn't there? Because British farmers would then be asked, with competing in that landscape, they'd be producing things against European farmers that are highly subsidised and American farmers that are highly subsidised. So, yeah, it's hard to see how that would result in a enlightened land management. It looks like it would result in a race to the bottom.
So what's going to happen?
So what's going to happen is we're going to have an unholy mess, I think, in the next few months until people wake up and realise that this matters. And, I didn't set out to be political or to bore people on your radio show with the politics of this. I really set out to write a beautiful book about my dad and my granddad and what we were and what we became and what we can be again. That was my dream.
Yep.
The nice thing is it started a conversation in the UK and elsewhere in America and other places where all I can do now is stick my head up and say, hey, everybody, you need to think about this stuff, because we swept this off stage, out of sight, out of mind, and it's going to cause real problems all around the world. We have to think about this. We have to say, what is actually happening in our landscapes? What are the forces making it happen? How could we help our farmers to be better? Just help them to, A, make a living, B, do it sustainably, and create those native habitats and processes and landscapes that are going to work for the future, that's going to be there. And I think a hell of a lot of farmers, yes, there are some grumpy right-wing farmers that won't like what I'm saying, but there's a hell of a lot of farmers, particularly young ones, who really get this now, who really get that we have to win back the trust of the public all around the world. And the way to do that is by being more sensible about this.
So hang on, let me get this straight. You want subsidies, but you want subsidies geared more towards environmental protection rather than production.
Yeah, that's the direction of travel in the UK. And I broadly welcome it. I think if you just simply take away subsidies and ask a group of farmers in any country to then compete with subsidised farmers who are doing destructive things on their land, that's not going to work, is it? So, long-term, it'd be much better if we paid the true price of food from good farming systems and there was no need for subsidy. I think that would be everybody's ideal. But in the imperfect position that Britain finds itself in at the moment, I would support continuation of subsidies, but spend them much, much more widely in the public interest.
Which doesn't bode
wisely,
well.
Wisely, not widely.
Right. But which doesn't bode well, and I mean, you could care less about this, for the US-UK trade deal, because the US would say that any kind of subsidy, even environmental subsidy, is a hidden subsidy and contrary to free trade.
They might, but they spend vast amounts on subsidising their agriculture through federal crop insurance and all sorts of other crazy things that they do over there. So, they might argue that. They do. They call environmental payments to anybody that manages land hidden subsidies, and they try to discourage it. Yeah, so, needless to say, I didn't make this mess. I'm just talking about what a mess we find ourselves in and how we might get ourselves out of it.
So,
and it looks to me like the least bad thing, least bad thing at the moment in Britain would be a better subsidy system.
The least bad thing, crikey. Here's what you say explicitly in your book. As farmers, we now have to reconcile the need to produce more food than any other generation in history with the necessity to do that sustainably and in ways that allow nature to survive alongside us. Is that possible?
I think it is. I think it is. And if you don't believe me, you need to start Googling regenerative agriculture. Start looking at the amazing things that livestock farmers like Greg Judy are doing. If you look on YouTube or you look at Richard Perkins in Sweden, there are these amazing farmers now that are farming in sustainable, sensible ways that create biodiversity, that look after soil, but which are hugely productive. But the irony of those systems is that they're not based on these industrial inputs. They're using people much more wisely. They're using skill much more wisely, and they're using better techniques. So to give you one example of that, we know in the UK that if we maximize photosynthesis through clever grazing, we can raise the productivity of grassland, which is what I farm, by 20 to 30%. Now, if I can raise the productivity of my grassland by 20 to 30% over what my father did without synthetic fertilizers, then I can start to think about bits of my farm that are less productive being some kind of wildlife habitat, and I can still have as much livestock as I used to have. So we've got to look for these clever win-wins, and they do exist if you care to find them.
George Monbiot has argued, and you've got your Hardwick sheep there. Hardwick sheep. Herdwick. You're a grazing farm now. You don't grow crops. George Monbiot has said that sheep farming is destructive. Would you regard him as an example of the old dichotomy, you know, farmers bad and urban liberals good? Because what else are you going to do wisely on your farm except graze sheep?
So that's the point. The vast majority of the UK, something like 75% of it, is grazing land. And you, even if you want to, and yes, some people do, you can't magic away the people on it. So you've really got two choices. You've got, can you turn them into much more enlightened land stewards? Or do you just let them make things worse in a sort of race to the bottom? So he's partly right, but as George sometimes is, he's partly right. You can farm sheep in ways that trash environments. There's absolutely no doubt about it. The question I would argue is, can you farm sheep in better ways than that, that build diversity? Can you farm them in patchwork landscapes that are full of native habitats? Can you do this in an enlightened way that isn't damaging? And I think the answer is yes. In fact, I know the answer is yes, because I spent 10 years doing that on our land and in our valley. So it's just, for me, it's just a little bit too easy to go into the sort of demonization of farmers. I think we need to look at why they did the things they did and what else they could do and why that might work.
Tell me a little bit about your Herdwick sheep. Why are they special?
So Herdwick sheep are amazing. They genetically, they're a combination of the ancient British sheep that would have been in this landscape and then some Viking sheep DNA. We now think that the Vikings, they got a bad rap, didn't they? A bad PR rap, because all the histories was written by Christian monks that were robbed by them. But it turns out the Vikings were sailing around with sheep and cattle on their boats and were largely a farming and sheep people. And they came to these valleys where I live. Probably some of my ancestors are Vikings. And they brought many of those sort of Scandinavian farming systems and many of the words and many of the practices and traditions. And yeah, they had these systems where they worked out how very poor people in very hilly, wet, cold places could live. And that's how my people settled in this place. That's how they've lived there for 1,000+ years. And I think there's a great deal of good in that. And if we can just get rid of some of the damage that they did, particularly in the last 50 years, rethink our role in these landscapes and reshape them a little bit, I think we can be here in another 1,000 years.
What would your grandfather say about what you're doing right now?
I think he would love that the farm looks well, that our land's in really good health. My grandfather loved things like barn owls, and I think he would love how much wildlife was on the farm. And above all, I think he'd just be really proud that we'd found a way to stick in and still be here. And that wasn't a foregone conclusion. This is a little farm, little marginal farm up in the hills. We could very easily have fallen away from it in the last 20 or 30 years. And we've sort of stuck in and been very stubborn and stayed here. And I think he would be pleased about that, because this landscape's written over with the work that he did, the walls that he built, the hedges that he laid, and the same with my father and gates. You know, everywhere I go on this farm, it's covered in the work of my father and grandfather and others before me. And yeah, my dad died 6 years ago, and some days I forget he's dead because I can see his work all around me, and you get a lot of comfort from that. And yeah, I think a farm's more than a business, if I'm really honest. I think it's where you put down your roots and the place that you love and the place that represents your values and your culture. And yeah, I think it's a thing we can fight back from against forces that are trashing the world.
We can all understand that farming is more than a business, but it's also less than a business, James. And you've decided not to ruin your health by trying to earn a living solely from the land.
No, to be honest, I run my farm business as a business. I don't top it up with other money. It has to pay. I get up every morning. I work on the farm. I do my writing at night, actually. So even my daylight hours aren't much affected by being a writer. So no, this is about serious farming. This is about staying in the same place. And it's about getting out of that input-based agriculture, which all of the farmer listeners in New Zealand will recognize this. The thing that kills small farms is the input costs. The big machinery, the fertilizers, the other stuff you have to pay people for. And if there's ways to farm on your land that require much, much less of that, potentially none of that, and you can still be in that place, still live a good life, eat good food, look after your family, look after your community, then I think people will embrace that and want to take it forwards. I don't think most farmers think of themselves purely as business people. Yes, they've got to be businesslike at times, but it's much, much more than that. It's about how we live and what kind of landscapes we want and what kind of society we want.
One thing you might have a bit of argument with your grandfather about is the fact, and it's been discovered over the last 30 years, as you write in the book, that ploughing is ecologically disastrous.
Yeah. Well, who knew? Who would have known?
Who knew?
But anybody that cares to... Yeah, but anyone that cares to, anyone that listens to soil scientists now knows that the persistent breaking up of the ground, tillage with a plow, is not good for the ground. It's not good for soil microbiology. It's potentially something we can do periodically as part of rotational cropping if we then let the ground recover and natural processes take place. But yeah, we're all part of a society that was built by the plow. And yet we now know that that's potentially problematic. So that's why farmers all around the world are looking at no-till and other techniques whereby you can leave the ground in place and not disturb it, or disturb it as little as possible.
I'm getting a number of texts in on this subject, so I'll just address them. I'm not really expecting you to have expertise in this area, but the texts go along the lines of this. New Zealand, and you'll know this, James, anyway, New Zealand removed all farming subsidies in the 1980s. We survived while competing with many other countries who still had subsidies. It can be done. To which I would respond, yes, it can be done, but at the environmental cost of industrial farming.
I suspect the answer runs a bit like that, and I don't want to upset all of your farmer listeners, but I do see a lot of pictures that they post on social media of what look like hills that were once wooded and now aren't. And I do hear, just as we have grave ecological problems in Britain, I know that you do too, about rivers and other things. So, I'm not going to argue with you that subsidies are an imperfect solution. It's not something I want. I'd rather that didn't exist. I'd rather that I, as a farmer, was paid the proper price of producing food sensibly. And something else I should say and give credit to is that there is a real, and I unashamedly say this, there's a real waking up, particularly among sheep and cattle farmers in Britain, to just how good many of the New Zealand and Australian farmers are in terms of being at the cutting edge of technologies about grazing, about animal health, about breeding better animals that can cope with the places that they live better. So I'm not in any sense sticking my head in the ground. I have been to New Zealand and Australia, and there's loads we can learn to be more effective farmers. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But it does come back at the end of the day. There are limits to that. If you think about what the British landscape is and what the British landscape people, what kind of landscape the British people want, they don't want me to create the American Midwest. They don't want it. they actively legislate against it. So we can't do that. So either then you're so uncompetitive that you offshore your food footprint to places like the Amazon, which is more disastrous, or you've got to do imperfect things to sustain it against unfair competition from other places. So, you know, I'm not on here to be a British farmer whinging about wanting subsidy. That's not my angle at all. I'd much rather that wasn't necessary. And I do understand that New Zealand farmers are in a quite different situation. But, yeah.
Yeah, just talking about hedgerows for a moment, another text says, 30 years ago, Canterbury rural landscape was covered in hedgerows supporting our biodiversity, but along came dairy farming, which utterly denuded the landscape and took away the hedgerows, and along with it, habitats for our wildlife creatures. And dairying, James, as you'll know, is the kind of the bête noire of the urban liberal in New Zealand, because it's the mainstay of our economy in many ways, and yet it demands so much from the environment.
Yeah, and it's difficult because supermarkets pay such low prices for milk that you have to fight dairy farm in a certain way just to survive. There's often very little choice in that if you're a farmer. So I'm not here being smug about that. Farmers are put in these really impossible situations, and they're price takers, and they have to adapt to survive. I think what's really interesting is to ask how it might be different, how you might get to a different place, and how you might re-engineer landscapes to have the right amount of native habitats and other things in them. You can not give a damn about that if you choose to. I personally think that's unwise. But if you do give a damn about it, then it's probably best not to get mad with farmers. It's probably better to have some kind of dialogue with them about how it could be different, how they can claw back from that and create something else.
What would your father say if he were around?
He'd I get asked this a lot. I think he'd love all the new fences we have. So by working with a lot of the conservation charities, we've reconfigured the farm. We now have an incredibly well-fenced farm, actually, with some of the best grazing management we've ever done. We know a whole heap more than we've ever known about how to graze really, really well. My sheep and cattle are in tremendous health and are doing very well at the sales and shows and other things. So I think he'd come back, he'd be proud of how good the livestock was. I don't think he'd think I'd sold out and become a sort of hippie writer or something. I think he would see there was some real farming going on and that we were still serious about what we did. And then there'd be a few things that would puzzle him, like the Wrigley River through his hay meadow. He'd be wondering what the hell had got into me when I did that. But I think over a beer or a coffee, I could soon explain to him what I know now that he didn't know and why that's probably a good idea.
He did it hard, didn't he, your dad?
Yeah, my dad was one of that generation that had to graft through this. There wasn't a lot of option. You were doing the work on a farm of two or three people. Okay, you had bigger machines or what have you. The prices were coming down in real terms. The debts were going up. Yeah, my dad had to slog it out. And, like, my family aren't moneyed or anything like that. They're just ordinary working people. And my memories of my dad when I was a kid were, this is a guy that'd be out working 10 or 11 o'clock at night. He'd be up next morning at 6 o'clock. There was no holidays. There was nothing. This is just a guy who was doing the best he could for his family, trying to tough it out. And I admire that. There's no part of me looks down my nose at that. It just got to the stage maybe 10 or 15 years ago where we had to stop a little bit and look at it and go, hang on a minute. Even with all that work, we're not winning at the moment. We have to change things. And yeah, and on our farm, I'm not saying the way we farm would work for everybody, but on our farm, we made the best profit we've made for 5 or 6 years last year with making all of these changes, because we've reduced the input costs and we're getting out of a system that was screwing us. So I have no regrets. I can look anybody in the face and show them my livestock. I can look an ecologist in the face and tell them I'm doing the best I can, and many of them are pleased with that. And I can show anybody my accounts and say, look, we're here and we're surviving, and we wouldn't be if we'd carried on the old way. So I'm not saying everyone has to, but Here it seems to be working.
One of the nicest descriptions of your grandfather you have is his ability to look, his ability to observe, to be quiet and observe. Are you able to do that?
Yeah, much, much more so. So we've reduced the stock a little bit on the farm, and then we've got rid of some of the stock that was high input and high maintenance. And yeah, we're trying to get back to a system that's as grass-based as possible. And yeah, that's leaving us with more time, really. And And also there's more people coming on the farm because people want to be part of this. When farmers are doing the stuff that their communities believe in, then people step up and want to help you and want to compliment you and be part of it. So, I mean, that's a huge part of my life. I don't want to be accused of wrecking the landscape. I don't want to be accused of wrecking rivers. My grandfather, my dad both thought they were good stewards. It turns out they were imperfect stewards technically. And I just think once you know that, you've got to do a little bit better. So I think my generation's job is to step up and do a little bit better. And yeah, a lot of that is about looking, isn't it? It's about being aware of the insect life around you. It's about being aware of your grazing impacts. It's about thinking, listening to other people and thinking, hang on a minute, what's missing from my farm, or what's not working? What's making things worse for nature? And yeah, and probably making some tough decisions as well about maybe some of the livestock doesn't pay, or it's the wrong thing in the wrong place. Yeah, it's not all easy, but that's life, right?
In your book, you talk about how you dealt with a thistle bit. You sprayed them and great, the thistles went away. What do you do with thistles now?
So we don't have a major thistle problem anymore. So part of the problem was we were sowing a huge amount of nitrogen and we had a lot of cattle on the ground and they were chewing it up. And then the next year we'd get this huge infestation of thistles. So no, we've got back to a different grazing system now where we don't really have a thistle problem anymore. But yeah, that was one of the tipping moments for me, because I remember being really excited by, and pesticides wasn't a word we used. We just call it sprays. But in the sort of late 1980s, early 1990s, I can remember how radical it was on our farm to get rid of all the thistles almost overnight. So you think, wow, this is a miracle. We don't have to go out with a scythe. My granddad doesn't have to go out with a pasture topper on the back of the tractor to mow it. And you think, wow, we've cured that overnight. What an amazing thing. And I was genuinely excited by it. And now I look back and think, oh my God, that was quite a heavy duty pesticide we were knocking about everywhere. And I shut away other memories, and I read about it in the book. I remember years later it came back to me that the morning after I'd sprayed the thistles, I found all the chicks were dead in one of the robin's nests near the gate in the field where I'd sprayed. And I sort of told myself at the time it was nothing to do with the spray, but of course looking back now I know that it was. We've just got to be really, really careful with these tools that we've armed ourselves with over the last 50 years. We now know that this is pretty dangerous stuff we've been playing with.
The birds have come back. You mentioned the barn owls. Curlews. Tell me about the curlews. Yeah.
So curlews are, for anyone that doesn't know about curlews, curlews are this sort of wader bird with a big sort of big brown bird, about 18 inches high maybe. Curly beaked, and they winter on the estuaries and the coast of Britain, and then in the spring they come back inland and they live on farmland. Basically they're an iconic farmland bird, particularly in the north of England. They have this beautiful call above the fields, and they were everywhere when I was a kid, and now they're vanishing really, really quickly. And for me, they're one of they're like a sort of canary in the mine shaft type thing, because when something as common as that, something that you've grown up with, is disappearing from the fields all around you, I think for me that was a moment where I went, hang on a minute, what's happening? Why is that gone? Why have we done something that's meant that this beautiful bird has disappeared? And the more I looked into it, I realized it was that grassland was being managed more intensively. The mowing date was coming early because of synthetic fertilizers and nitrogen. We were mowing maybe one more time a year than we had in the past. Maybe three times instead of two times. There just wasn't time for a curlew to get their chicks off the ground. So this bird that everyone thinks of in England as being sort of part of our national life, part of everyday healthy land, is disappearing really quickly. There are fears it's going to, it is disappearing for most of Britain at the moment. And yeah, you can say, I don't care about a curlew, but again, I'm not sure that's a good take. I think we have to think about these things before we do them. And when we see things falling off the table, things that matter, I think we have to ask ourselves whether we've gone too far.
If you hadn't gone to Oxford and done that double first in history, and then, you know, worked for UNESCO and World Bank around the world, various types of farming all around the world, would you be where you are now, thinking what you're thinking?
That's a good question. I don't know, because I obviously didn't live that counterfactual. But
No.
the truth, what's interesting is I think half, maybe two-thirds of the farmers within 5 miles of where I live right now are coming to the same conclusions at the same time, which suggests to me that this is nothing to do with me. This is more about a growing awareness, which you can't escape if you're a farmer, that the negatives are building up, the questions are building up, the distrust is building up. And farmers of all kinds of backgrounds, of all kinds of sort of people with all kinds of levels of education are reaching the same conclusion, which is, hang on a minute, let's just stop here a little bit. Let's have a think about what it is we're doing. And yes, a minority of farmers probably come to the conclusion, well, I don't care about any of this. My job's just to produce food. Well, great. If you can get away with that and that's what you want to do, okay. But I think most of us are going to say, actually, we're going to have to compromise. We're going to have to think really, really carefully about this to get multiple outcomes from farming and land management, not just the cheapest food.
And as a consumer, which is pretty much all I am, what can I do to get rid of the slavery to consumerism, the addiction to cheap food? Buy more expensive food? What?
Well, maybe if you're lucky enough to be able to afford it,
Well,
and
that's
I'm
the issue,
guessing you
isn't it?
can,
Lucky
then
enough.
well, that's right, and that's why I'm not preaching that poor people should spend more on food. I think we're going to need some very productive agriculture in places, and yes, the poorest people in our society need to be thought about whatever you do to the food system. I have no problem with that. It's really important, but that isn't an excuse for you or I not to do something about it if we can afford to. And I would suggest that when you go to a restaurant, you ask a lot more questions, and when you go to a shop, you ask a lot more questions. And yes, you're busy, and lots of your readers are busy, and lots of mums in particular at a supermarket. They've got two or three kids, four kids in my case. And who's got time to read all of the labels? Probably no one. But just to the greatest extent you possibly can, try buying food from farming systems that you approve of, whether that's organic or pasture fed or whatever else it might be. Try and support the good guys. And is that a perfect solution? No, but it's a start. And start learning about this stuff. Start if you can. Try and learn about this stuff, and try and think about how you and your family and your community can do better. And if you have farmers not far from your town, your city, your village, try and talk to them. Okay, some farmers are grumpy, but just ignore the grumpy ones. Try and talk to them, ask what they sell, ask what you can support, try and understand what they're trying to do. If we can mobilize as families and then communities and streets and neighborhoods, I think we can make different things happen. I really, really do. I think we can make this better. And yeah, I'm actually optimistic. I think it's one of the most exciting times to be a farmer ever.
Thank you,
And it
James.
just requires us all to work together.
Thank you, James Rebanks. His book is called English Pastoral, An Inheritance.